above the water. Said the leader, looks like an Israelite.
Cause of Kona trouble, the water.
Everybody say wait. See that band all dressed in red.
Cause a cone of trouble, the water.
Well, it looks like the band that moves is
laying.
Wait in the water.
Wait in the water.
Wait in the water.
Wait
in the water. Children
wait.
He's gonna trouble. He's gonna trouble. He's gonna trouble our
children.
He's gonna trouble.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, we will hear a recording of an event that occurred earlier this month from the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, Andrea Hairston and Pan Morrigan. Just trust me and stay tuned. Good morning. The reading series that I produce has recently just gone into either fits. Well, it's gone into fits and starts. We started off the year, not the season, but the year, with Gary Steingart and Rick Moody, two names that, if you are familiar with literature, are, you know, both, you know, major writers, major bestsellers. And then February was something that was arranged last July. Andrea Hairston is this just amazing writer, an amazing woman, but also an amazing writer, who turns out simply not enough novels. Her second novel just recently came out, Redwood and Wildfire, which is what we're going to be hearing from in a little while. But we have some minor business to deal with first. So, she had teamed up with this wonderful musician whose work I had heard before, and by a complete coincidence, Amma Patterson, herself a fine writer, for Christmas gave me an album of Pan's music, which I'm now very sorry I didn't bring with me. I think I can find a cut to play before the show is over, even though I don't have the album. You'll be hearing a lot of her singing, but I'm afraid, because of the circumstances, a little of it is off microphone. So, but we are nevertheless going to try to make up for that with some studio work. Okay, so anyway, our readings are usually the first Tuesday of every month, and of course, as the 2 days before, we announced, yes, we're going ahead, yes, we're going on, but as luck would have it, no, there wasn't more snow in New York, but there was ice up in the Boston area near where both Pan and Andrea live. And there was just no way that they were going to be able to get the car out, drive from Boston down to New York. And Andrea teaches college, and on Tuesday. So we had to move it to a Thursday, et cetera, et cetera. In the meantime, I had planned a specific event to writers Lev Grossman and Barbara Krasnov for March. And then all of a sudden, it all worked out. Andrea wanted to do her makeup, as it were, in the makeup event in March, and it worked out perfectly. So on March 6th, Sunday, March 6th, we held the event that was originally slated. The first Tuesday of April, which is, in fact, this coming Tuesday, April 5th, will be what was in my head originally, the March reading, Lev Grossman, and I'll tell you about him, and Barbara Krasnov in just a moment. And then the very week after that, we're going to do a special event, a special reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings with Carol Emshwiller. Oh, Carol, you say, well, that reading series has been going on for 20 years, and this must be her seventh or eighth time reading there. Well, that may very well be true, but that's her birthday. So we thought, what a good reason. Oh, it's her 90th birthday. Well, ain't no question. That just means that we're going to be doing two events in April, and that's all there is to it. So let's start by my telling you all about the event coming this Tuesday, and then I'll tell you about the event that we held 3 weeks ago on a Sunday. And then you will actually hear that event coming up this Tuesday, April 5th, at 7 p.m. at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, 138 Sullivan Street. And by the way, if you need any more of this information, I'll repeat it again later, but it's also available on my website, ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. I also have an event for this built up on Facebook. And you can join my mailing list, which is actually not for the radio show. It's just for that reading series, by sending me an email, jim@ourwolf.com. Again, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F, like the name of this show. So, the reading begins, give or take a few minutes, at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. And Barbara Krasnoff will be our first reader. And her short fiction has appeared in Apex Magazine, Space and Time, Electric Velocipede, Apex Magazine, Doorways, two issues of Sybil's Garage, Behind the Waistcoat, Escape Velocity, Weird Tales, Descant, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, Amazing Stories. And the anthology is Descended from Darkness, which is Apex Magazine Volume 1, Crossed Genres, Year 2, where she has a new story. I don't know if it's out yet or about to come out. I think about to come out. Blah, blah, blah. Clockwork Phoenix 2, Such a Pretty Face, Tales of Power and Abundance as part of Such a Pretty Face, and Memories and Visions, Women's Fantasy and Science Fiction. Recent sales include In the Household of the Brelsch, which will be in the April edition of Cross Genres, close enough, Button Up Your Overcoat, which will be included in Broken Time Blues, Fantastic Tales in the Roaring Twenties, and Red Dybbuk, which will be part of a yet unnamed anthology. She will be reading Red Dybbuk, by the way. She is, during working hours, the features and reviews editor for Computer World magazine and website. A member of the New York City writers group Tabula Rasa. It says here she lives in Brooklyn, New York, with Jim Freund, whoever that is, and countless numbers of stuffed penguins. Excuse me? Those are my penguins. But and I will point out that this is about the fourth time that Barbara is reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, but the first time I've booked her, okay? This is the first act of nepotism, but only on her fourth reading. So since three other curators, starting with, I think the first one who booked her was Cherie Renee Thomas, the editor of Dark Matter, of the diaspora of African-American science fiction. Since she has been, who's also who I met Andrea Hairston through, by the way, since she has been vetted, included by such people as that, I feel like, okay, so can I. And also, a little bit before Passover, it seemed fitting. Now, she's a technology writer and editor, and with her will be Lev Grossman. Lev Grossman's first novel, Warp, was published in 1998. His second codex appeared in 2004 and became an international bestseller. Okay, Barbara writes short stories, Lev writes bestsellers. The Magicians, his third, earned a rare combination of popular and critical acclaim. It debuted at number 8 on the New York Times bestseller list and was one of the New Yorker's best books of 2009. It is currently being published in 20 countries. The sequel, The Magician King, is slated for publication this fall. The son of two English professors, Lev grew up in Boston, studied literature at Harvard, and spent 3 years doing his PhD at Yale before realizing that a career in comparative literature was not for him. So he set about becoming a journalist and is currently a senior writer at Time magazine, serving as both book critic and lead technology writer. It doesn't say it here, but I can tell you that he wrote last year's, a Person of the Year article about Zuckerberg, Facebook, about Mark Zuckerberg, and then followed it up with the writer and director of Social Network. So that was sort of interesting. New York Times called him one of the country's smartest and most reliable critics. His writing has also appeared in The Times, The Village Voice, Entertainment Weekly, Salon, Lingua Franca, and The Wall Street Journal, among many others. And he appears as a frequent guest on NPR, whatever that is. He lives in Brooklyn, New York, and is married to author Sophie G. So we basically have two tech writers from Brooklyn, New York, who write fantasy. So that's this coming Tuesday, April 5th, at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. It's part of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. I am producing, and I hope to see you there. Admission is free. And although we do ask donations, but admission is free. Want to know what one of these things sounds like? You're about to hear one. This event, as I was telling you, the misbegotten dates and acts of goddess or whomever that canceled some, made others, and also gave us our very first Tuesday afternoon event. Pan Morrigan, the musician involved here, is an award-winning vocalist, songwriter, composer, multi-instrumentalist, and producer. She is known for her silvery, wide-ranging voice and passionate stage presence. Her genre-bending songs are influenced by the wide, stormy skies and wild lakes of the Midwest, where she was raised. The experience of growing up in a city full of immigrants and seekers also helped shape her musical imagination. Blues and jazz, Irish, Greek, Persian, and Scottish music were everywhere to be heard. Live friends held Irish sessions in their basements. Greek bands were heard in local clubs with rooms for dancing sirtos between tables. Pan's father made instruments for folk musicians, and the sounds of American folk, blues, and Persian classical music alike were heard in the kitchen. Most importantly, Pan learned that music had no boundaries and could not be fenced in. And for more information, visit her website, PanMorrigan.com, PanMorrigan.com. And you can find out more about her new CD there, Wild Blue. Now, she wrote songs inspired and tying into, as you will hear, this novel called Redwood and Wildfire, brand new book published by Aqueduct Press. Beautifully published, I should mention, nice edition, by Andrea Hairston. Andrea was a math physics major in college until she did special effects for a show and ran off to the theater to become an artist. She's the artistic director of Chrysalis Theater, who, by the way, is going to be producing a radio drama here for WBAI based on Until Forgiveness Comes by Tempest Bradford. So we have more to look forward to. And has created original productions with music, dance, and masks for over 30 years. She is also the Louise Wolf Kahn 1931 Professor of Theater and Afro-American Studies at Smith College. Her plays have been produced at Yale Rep, Rights and Reason, the Kennedy Center, Stage West, and on public radio and television. She has received many playwriting and directing awards, including a National Endowment for the Arts grant to playwrights, a Rockefeller/NEA grant for new works, a Ford Foundation grant to collaborate with Senegalese master drummer Bassamba Diop, that's D-I-O-P, but I believe it's pronounced Diop, and a Schubert Fellowship for playwriting. Her first novel, Mindscape, an amazing novel, was published by Aqueduct Press in March 2006. Mindscape won the Carl Brandon Parallax Award and was shortlisted for the Philip K. Dick Award and the Tiptree Award. Griots of the Galaxy, a short story, appears in So Long Been Dreaming, Postcolonial Visions of the Future, an anthology edited by, it doesn't say here, I will add it, the wonderful and amazing Nalo Hopkinson and Upinder Mihan. In March 2011, Ms. Hairston will receive, I guess by now has received, the International Association of the Fantastic and the Arts Distinguished Scholarship Award for distinguished contributions to the scholarship and criticism of the fantastic. Her new novel, Redwood and Wildfire, has just been published by Aqueduct Press and has been reviewed by The Village Voice. I guess go to The Voice and type that in, Redwood and Wildfire. I can tell you that the review was written by Carol Cooper. She is currently working on a new novel, Will Do Magic for Small Change, and her website is AndreaHairston.com, H-A-I-R-S-T-O-N, Andrea Hairston. Okay. That's who you're going to be hearing, and that's where we're going to go. And my God, we're almost out of time. I better start this thing because it runs the full length. I will apologize in advance for the quality of the music. I use a single microphone. It is what they call an XY pair, and it pans out across the stage, and it's really not bad. We hear Andrea perfectly, and we hear much of Pan's music, but her voice sounds somewhat echoey, and I am sorry for that. But we have arranged that when Andrea and Pan come back to New York City in August, where Andrea will be reading again at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series, and we will use that opportunity to record Tempest's radio drama, we're also going to do a studio production of the live performance that you are about to hear. That doesn't mean don't listen now. That means let this whet your appetite. So, set your Wayback Machine to March 6th, just a few weeks ago.
I should shut up because we have an incredible show. So may I present Pam Morgan and Andrea Hairston.
Night falls with a simple song, not too short, not too long. What's done is done, not fixed must lay. Time and love overs refrain. The doors of twilight fall open wide, our shadows mix in dulcet light. And how I love the sound of you, the tune, the tone, rhythm of you. Oh, we sang and we were sung, and on and on and on and on. A simple song, a simple song. This little thing will do its best to stay in tune,
but you'll forgive it. It goes out.
La 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 la. You didn't dance much in those funny brown shoes. You are the storm cloud. You
take you, and the moon will hold you, and the wind will rock you, and the night will know you, and the night will take you, and the moon will hold you, and the stars will rock you, and the dark will know you, the dark will know you. Dance, little sister, dance, 'cause the moon is swinging.
Chapter 1, Peach Grove, Georgia, 1898. I can't keep running. Christmas moonbeams snuck through the break in the live oak trees, and Redwood Phipps planted her 11-year-old self in the cold, silvery light. Long legs and all, she was bone tired. Big Brother George, her teary cousins, and wild-eyed grown-ups were leapfrogging through Grandmother Oaks, much wider than they were tall, and so tangled up in one another, could have been a square mile of one tree. A maze of moss-covered boughs going every which way at once tripped up any fool aiming for speed. Redwood pressed her feet into the muck and felt fat old roots holding down the ground. She leaned against gnarled branches, holding back the sky. Warm as an ember in the small of her back, little sister Iris cooed in her sleep and burped sweet baby breath. Redwood turned her face to the stars, shivered, and closed her eyes. The wind picked up. Sharp oak leaves sliced at her arms. She wanted to conjure herself somewhere else and give her poor legs a rest. But she just had to drop back into this mad dash to nowhere. And why try for some other where and when without mama to catch her if she got lost, without anybody to believe? Redwood sank down on a mossy bough and rubbed an angry calf. All they'd been doing for days was run down dusty roads, through cold swamp mud, over the dead stalks of winter oaks. Since a week ago, must be. Mama woke her up in the middle of a sweet singing and dancing dream, and then they raced out into a nightmare. Red flames flared against the black sky. Babies screamed, and pale night riders pumped shotguns at shadows darting through the trees. A posse of white men were going buck mad all over colored Peach Grove. Whose fault was that? Yellow fever took Daddy to glory this past summer. Otherwise, the family wouldn't have been running at all. That's what George said. Redwood tried not to be mad at Daddy for leaving and at Mama for letting him go. When it was really your time, even a powerful conjure woman like Mama couldn't cheat the Boneyard Baron from his due. First, it was just them running. Mama with baby Iris on her back and Big Brother George holding Redwood's hand. Then, 2 days ago, after the sun sank into mustardy mist, Miss Subi lurched out of the swamp grass, gray hair riding across her head, whiskers on her jaw twitching. Demon posse going wild, and I was high and dry, out of harm's way. Why you all calling me out into this swamp between a hoot and a holler? Redwood snorted as Mama and Miss Subi hid behind the dome roots of a cypress tree to argue. Posse tracking them wouldn't get nowhere but lost. Mama's hoodoo spells kept them safe. She had secret places nobody could hardly find. And Miss Subi, you know, she had that cataract eye, wasn't too good at seeing in the daylight, get lost in her own front yard, and she never wanted to bother with gators or snakes or mosquitoes. Mama must have left a hoodoo trail Miss Subi could follow with her eyes closed. Had to follow, probably. And didn't she teach Mama conjuring? So why all the fussing and cussing? Garnet Phipps, you can run through fire and not get burnt. Miss Subi raised her voice loud enough for Redwood and George to hear. But that won't put it out. Well, what are you asking me to do, huh? Mama shouted too. Stay here and what? I'm not asking you to do anything. Redwood had never heard Subi sound so shaky. If you go on, go. Otherwise, you running these little ones ragged. Mama didn't say much after that. She hugged and kissed Iris and Redwood and fixed them in her eyes. But when it came to George, he pretended like he was too grown for Mama still loving him like her baby. I'm 16, New Year's Day, 1899. A man now, ain't I? He said. While we've been running in circles, what you plan to do now? Mama glared at George, but he kept right on. Why can't you tell me what's what? Can't nobody tell you what's what? All the mad drained out of Mama's eyes. You gotta figure that for yourself. Mama hugged him hard, and he didn't want to let her go. She pulled away. Y'all watch over each other, you hear me? She squeezed Redwood's hand till it hurt. Keep a lookout, Subi, for my children. Keep a lookout. And then Mama took off on her own, mud up to her thighs, titties dripping milk, tears aching in her eyes. We're gonna catch up with your mama later, Subi said. She got hard business to take care of. I can help, Redwood said. If she's doing a tricky spell? Subi didn't answer right off. No, we need you to stay here with us. Redwood wanted to run after Mama, but knew better than to make a big fuss. I mean, didn't she have to sing to keep baby Iris from howling? Indeed, Redwood sang till they found Annalisa, who let Iris suck, because ought to be trying to wean your cousin, so drink me dry, gal. 2 days gone by since then, the whole Raggedy family on the run. Uncle Lad, Annalisa, the 5 cousins too, sniffling, stumbling, and ain't nobody seen another sign of Mama. Not Uncle Lad, who could track anything walking, nor Miss Subi on the lookout for a hoodoo trail. Mama's hard business was taking too long. Redwood peered through scraggly oak leaves curling against the chill. At least no more fires danced across the black face of night. Redwood tasted the air, drawing it slowly across her tongue. Cold ashes, cold soot. Maybe the nightmare was over. Maybe nobody needed to be running in circles no more, and she could lie down and catch a good sleep. Maybe Mama would come and take them home. What you doing? We gotta keep ahead of those night riders till it's safe to go back. Get up! George pulled her off the old oak bough. His arms were thick with muscle. He shook Redwood once, twice, and rattled her teeth the third time. Follow me. Should I take Iris? No. Iris wailed if she wasn't sucking on Annalisa or riding Redwood's back. Half an hour ago, despite bumping and jiggling through the woods, she got Iris to sleep, singing. Why mess in that? In the moonlight, George found a way through the crisscross of boughs, but Redwood lagged behind. Each step, her feet throbbed and her legs wobbled. Wet, heavy air choked aching lungs like she was breathing everybody's sweat. Her heart banged against her chest. Take your sister's hand, George, and keep a lookout. Annalisa talked like Mama for a moment. Redwood could have bust out crying. Nobody was really like Mama. George reached out grubby fingers and pulled her along, but his heart wasn't in it. Redwood stopped again. She wasn't running like them hound dogs who kept going even after their hearts stopped, even after they were dead. You feel something, sugar? The rest of us don't? Miss Subi placed a cool palm on Redwood's hot brow and drew the weary right to her fingers. A sign, all right. Her milky eye twitched. You think you can help us find your mama now? The whole family stood around Redwood, gawking. Well, you know how to track her, George said. Well, you can't find Mama if she don't want to be found. Redwood wondered what trick they were playing on her. Grown-ups were always hoarding the truth and lying, even though they said that was sin. She'll find us when she wants to. I'm too tired. Why you gotta be so stubborn? Have your way every time. George just wanted her to do what he wanted. I can't run no more, Redwood pouted. Garnet's communing with the angels, Annalisa said. She's too busy to find us. We gotta find her. Miss Subi scowled, but her rough palms on Redwood's cheeks pressed strength right into her. George is right. Garnet don't hide from you. We follow you, child. Go how fast you go. We count on you. Everybody nodded, even George. Subi wasn't one to sneak in the back door. She just spoke plain and true. Angels? Redwood sighed. What did the angels want with Mama? Well, play some music, lad. You know a gal like that. You think that's a good idea? Uncle Lad looked around the shadows. Why'd she say play if she don't mean it? Annalisa was about to be through with everybody, so Uncle Lad strummed his ratty banjo. He couldn't play worth a damn. And Georgia wondered why he dragged the old thing along when they were on the run, life and death. Lad kept strumming till he found joy to the world. Redwood was done pouting then. She started singing loud and nobody hushed her. Aiden Cooper heard the Christmas music and stumbled to a halt. Thick strands of sweaty black hair obscured his line of sight. A hoot owl screeched and he almost dropped the heavy burden that dug into his shoulder. He tried to breathe blood into constricted muscles. The alligator pouch on his belt was caught between his thighs. He danced it free, jiggling, juggling all that remained of Garnet Phipps's body. Not an hour ago, he'd cut her down from a Georgia pine that didn't burn when she did. He wrapped her in the white cloth his Aunt Caitlin used for bedsheets. Thinking on her flesh crackling and boiling away, Aiden gagged. A foul stink leaked through the layers of rough cotton. Despite the powerful roots and herbs he'd gathered, Aiden smelled dried semen and spit, burnt hair, charred bones, and all Miss Garnet's screams and those upstanding men, Christians, hooting and hollering, having a rip-roaring good old time, all still ringing in Aiden's ears, in his bones. Do right, Miss Garnet whispered, a spear right through his heart. How? Aiden spoke out loud to a ghost. 18 and going out his mind, he ought to know better. He ought to know something. Take her to somewhere before it's too late. It's already too late. Aiden told ancestors, talking at him on the wind. I saw Miss Garnet go up in flames. He wanted to fall over and not get up. His heart throbbed and like he'd been run through for sure. What good is anything now? He couldn't just leave Miss Garnet on somebody's doorstep. How awful for anyone to find her that way. Well, I couldn't leave her hanging in that pine, could I? The fellow banging at the banjo on Joy to the World played more wrong notes than right, but he didn't lose the tune altogether. The music calmed Aiden's heart. He cleared his sinuses and spit mucus and blood at the sandy ground. Long-leaf pine needles gouged at his bare arms. The night was unusually chill, near to freezing, and he was drenched in cold sweat, shivering in a north wind. Without meaning to, he was running again. Not heading anywhere in particular, he just couldn't stand still. And Miss Garnet was lighter when he was on the move. Bay branches smacked his face, but the scratches on his cheek barely registered. He was lost in a spell. The church loomed out of the dark. The clean white oak gleaming in moonbeams startled Aiden back to himself. 85 years ago, after sweating and groaning all day in the fields, slaves built this house of the Lord by starlight. When the very first prayer meeting in the new church came to a rousing end, half these devout slaves, filled with the spirit of the Holy Ghost, took their freedom into the swamps and on to Florida to live and die with the Seminoles. Paddy rollers chasing behind them got struck down by lightning, and their hound dogs got fried too. Overseer aimed to torch the church, but set fire to his own self. Man run around for hours, burning everything he touched, and nobody could put him out. They say he still be burning in hell. Now, even if this was a tall tale, the angry God of the Baptists made Aiden nervous. He was a sinner for sure, and no Hail Marys would help him here. God, Jesus, and the heavenly host had seen Aiden crouched up in that hunting perch doing squat while Miss Garnet, while those men. The door to the church was half open, and Aiden nudged it the rest of the way. Plain wooden pews and altar were bathed in a silvery glow coming in a window that was as clear as fresh air. Aiden couldn't remember this church ever being empty on Christmas Eve before. Squinting down the aisle, he saw a mouse run from a creche in front of the altar. Black bead eyes flashed a fleck of light. A carved wooden Mary cradled baby Jesus and smiled at Aiden. A few donkeys and sheep stared at him expectantly. One of the wise men, dressed in a Seminole patchwork coat, had a broken leg and was tipped on its side. Indian ancestors had their eye on him for sure. Aiden lurched past pews worn smooth by devout behinds and headed toward the creche. He laid his burden down gently, despite the tremble in his muscles. He wanted to say some words, speak a prayer, but he didn't know what he believed. Singers joined the banjo on Joy to the World, coming closer now. Aiden scattered a bundle of sweet bay branches and violet orchids across Miss Garnet's body. Outside the window, 12 riders in dark robes tore through the night, pounding the ground, raising a thick haze of dust. The singers and banjo player went silent. Aiden slid his daddy's hunting knife out the sheath on his thigh. The horses were wall-eyed and sweaty, tongues lolling and frothy. One rider's pale face blurred in the shadows as they disappeared. Aiden hugged himself and bent over Miss Garnet's body, trying not to scream or weep or break apart. The musician started in again. A child singer soloed and Joy to the World approached the church. A young girl stood in the doorway and sang her heart out. The music tore at Aiden's gut. He dashed behind the altar. A blur of grown-ups rushed by the gallery to Garnet's body. Someone wailed and covered any noise Aiden made struggling out the back. Subi! The child led us right to her mama! Miss Garnet's sister, Elisa Glover, said, her voice cracking. Must have been Lad banging on the banjo beside her. Clouds crossed the moon as Aiden sprinted to the trees. Subi, a dark woman in her 60s with a milky eye and wrinkled, gnarled fingers, stood in the doorway, her hands on the singer's shoulder. Aiden couldn't make out the young one. Her face swam in shadows. Taller than Subi, most likely it was Garnet's gal. Aiden was covered in shadows, too. Still and all, Subi spied him with that blind eye. She nodded once to him and ushered the gal into the church. Aiden raced on, banging through brush. He didn't feel himself, but even deep in the old oaks, he felt the family grieving. As the child sang a verse of joy to the world, Aiden didn't know. Everybody was hollering on top of Redwood singing. God is in heaven, Annalisa faltered. Communing with the angels. She's dead. Miss Subi talked over her. Redwood didn't want to believe it. An acrid smell filled the church like green pine wood burning. She felt as if scorched roots were coming apart beneath her feet, tearing through dirt, spraying bugs and mucky old leaves in the air. If she hadn't been singing, she'd have fallen over, or worse. She clung to each note longer than she should, louder than the pounding hooves drumming the road. Miss Subi didn't lie. Mama was dead and gone and never coming back. Redwood didn't know how she could stand it. She shook Miss Subi's cold, heavy hand off her shoulder. Singing louder helped her walk the aisle between the pews and push past her cousins, aunt, and uncle to George. He couldn't holler no more and stood at the creche staring at orchids on dusty white cloth wrapped around all that was left of Mama. Redwood took George's hand. He squeezed hard. On her back, Iris fussed. Redwood was full of tears, too, howling through joy to the world, louder than a baby, for Mama going off with the angels and leaving them behind. You singing like her! George shook so till he almost knocked Redwood down. Just like Mama! Hope burned through the hurt and held Redwood up. Everybody always said she was the spitting image of Mama. Sounded and acted like her, too. So Mama wasn't all the way dead. Redwood was a spell she left behind. Spells only work if you filled your heart, did them proper, and believed. So right then and there, she decided, no matter what, to sing, dance, and conjure up a storm. Just like Garnet Phipps. It was what she wanted to do anyhow, but now she had to do it for Mama's sake. Redwood's voice broke into wrong notes and lost words, wailing and sobbing out of tune for she didn't know how long. But then she got a good breath and sang on. No more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make his blessings flow. Far as the curse is found, far as the curse is found, far as the curse is found. Take yourself away, 'cause you're keen. The banjo because of Aiden Wildfire, who is an excellent banjo player, and she learned it in like a couple of months.
So,
yes, yeah. So this is a later chapter, 1910 in Chicago. Saeed is a Persian acrobat and friend to Redwood. They do vaudeville and film in Chicago. Chicago is a major early film town. Westerns and African safaris are shot on Chicago back lots. Like the documentary, Big Game Hunting in Africa, documentary. An actor plays Teddy Roosevelt, and Pullman Porters, African Americans, play the savages.
And let me just interrupt for a moment to tell you that this is WBAI in New York City. You are listening to Andrea Hairston and Pan Morgan, who are performing Sunday, March 6th, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. We now continue.
So Redwood's stage name is Sequoia. And your song. This is Aiden's song.
Running won't set you free. I'm loose and I can breathe.
Saeed and Redwood, dressed as savage Africans with grass skirts, animal skins, and gator teeth necklaces, paced the back lot of Chicago's newest motion picture factory. Large bones, turkey most likely, from a nearby slaughterhouse were stuck through their hair. They squatted in front of a round hut with a thatched roof. Other natives, similarly dressed, huddled near them at the edge of a jungle. Fake palm trees that had been added to local crab apple, sassafras, and dogwood trees. Redwood blew a purple prairie smoke blossom that trailed silvery filaments as it went to seed. "What part of Africa is this?" Saeed asked. "Chicago, Abyssinia," Redwood laughed. Saeed laughed too. "And who are we again?" "Nobody." Redwood suddenly turned glum and clutched Saeed. "What is it?" "A lion," grumbled. "What are they doing to that old cat?" She looked toward the sound. "They tease him to look ferocious," Saeed squinted. "He doesn't want to come out of the cage." "Oh," she hugged herself. "Well, I have an idea for a motion picture, a colored romance on a sea island." "No one will make that. White folk are scared of colored romance," Saeed shrugged. "Who'd come to see it?" "For a nickel, colored folks will. Don't they come to the club after hours to hear us, or head on over to the Pecan Theater to see All Colored Adventures in Darkville? White folk come too, everybody does." "I hear rumors the Pecan's gone broke and about to close down. You can't get rich entertaining niggers." "Don't be quoting Eddie to me." Histrionic yelling was followed by fevered drums. Saeed pulled her up. He put on his savage face. "Time to welcome the great white hunter." Throwing up her hands in exaggerated fright, Redwood ran with Saeed and a crowd of screaming savages toward a row of cameramen cranking away. Two days later. "I don't work with divas anymore." Mr. Payne looked like the dead president for True this afternoon as he yelled at the idle cast and crew on the back lot of his motion picture factory. The light was better outside, but 3 days wasted. Payne resented every red cent spent to keep a village of screaming savages on hand for the rampage and the big hunt. Redwood sucked her teeth. She slouched against a flimsy African hut and scratched the itchy grass skirt going to seed round her waist. "Payne's not yelling at you," Saeed scratched too. The lion was still refusing to act. Redwood wanted to yell at the lazy creature herself. "Well, they're happy." Saeed pointed at African savages rolling dice. Of course the Pullman Porter extras weren't complaining. In between grueling trips through wild country with cheapskate passengers, acting African put good money in their pockets. Shooting a moving picture, though, for Redwood and Saeed, who were headliners, real show folk itching to perform, they weren't strutting across the stage to get lost in applause and laughter and the audience sucking in one breath together. They were just waiting for the sun to escape clouds, for the crew to pamper finicky lenses or catch putts blown about by the wind machine. A turkey bone slid from Saeed's slippery hair. He shouldn't have tossed the kinky fright wig. Redwood sighed. "With this beetle-headed scenario, who can blame that lion for pouting in his dressing room?" "Get that lazy cat moving!" Payne coughed in his handkerchief and marched off. A cage door opened to the lion snarling and spitting. Several white cameramen looked anxious as they cranked images of this beast, old and broken tooth, but still a ferocious sight. A muscular handler with a pockmarked ruddy complexion and streaks of gray in his black hair smacked the lion in the belly with a big stick and cracked a whip. The lion snarled and swiped, mane bristling with rage. The handler cracked the whip again and caught the lion in the face. The animal drew back as the handler jabbed harder at skinny ribs. That ain't a good idea! Redwood shouted at the handler and then whispered to Saeed, that must hurt. Saeed groaned, too many people. This animal is frightened and very angry. With another whip crack from the sunburnt handler and more painful prodding, the lion retreated further into the cage instead of coming forward. The handler shouted and the lion crouched up against the bars, looking weary and pathetic. Damn fool, you want to get us fired? The handler was cussing the lazy beast, talking about an old bag of bones when the lion leapt. Redwood was stunned by the sudden power and grace of the rippling muscles, but something was wrong. With jaws gaping and claws slashing the air, the lion aimed itself at the foul-mouthed handler, whose whip now hung limp in his hand. The lion's golden eyes flashed murderous rage. The handler shook his head and turned his back as if he couldn't believe the lion would dare attack him. He moved in slow motion while the lion was a streak of light. Where are you going? Saeed yelled as Redwood ran toward the lion. A sharp wind from an electric fan tore the mane from the lion's neck to reveal a she-cat in disguise. Cast, crew, and cameraman gasped. The lioness was momentarily distracted by her costume problem. She shook violently till she was free of someone else's ratty old mane. The handler had gotten up to speed and was charging away. Too late. The lioness recovered her momentum and cut the distance between them in two easy bounds. She tore into his behind, ripping through the pants and sinking teeth into soft flesh. The handler howled. Redwood slowed to a walk, praying for a good spell to come to her. Two cameramen froze above their lenses. One thin, pale man continued to film, while the African savages and the white hunter screeched and knocked each other over, scurrying away. Redwood recognized the curly red beard and scraggly eyebrows, Nikolai Minsky. A determined fellow, he shook off his comrades, urging him to run, and continued to roll. They gripped their cameras and dashed away. The handler, with the lioness clamped to his butt, struggled toward Nikolai, begging for help. Nikolai's eyes darted up from his lens. Without a whip or a gun, what could he do? Running was his only safe option. Possessed, a demon driven to capture this deadly spectacle, Nikolai shifted his camera's vantage point and continued rolling. Redwood danced in front of the lioness. The wind got caught in her fierce moves. A train of fog snaked through the dust at her feet. Prairie smoke seeds, a cloud of silvery purple filaments spun around her head. As Redwood swirled like a hurricane brewing, the she-cat let go of butt flesh and raggedy pants and spit her mouth clear. She licked blood from her broken fangs. Stepping over the whimpering handler, the lioness crouched low and moved toward Redwood. A stiff wind chased clouds across the sky. Nikolai praised the returning sunlight as he cranked on his camera like a demon. Redwood sprang high in the air, cloaked in a cyclone of fog and prairie smoke. In the middle of the spin, she fixed her eye on the lioness. She felt a great thundering heart, wheezing lungs and aching joints. Front paws that had bounded through fire were tender. A bruised shoulder ached where the handler had poked too hard. Cheeks and eyes stung from the whiplash. Yet more than all this, Redwood tasted rage, killing rage, swallowed down too long and coming up strong now. Breath become rage, flesh become rage, and fangs and claws, the sharp edge of rage. Redwood landed at the lioness's nose. Prairie smoke seeds settled on her grass skirt, and fog evaporated in a whistling hiss over her head. The lioness came to a halt also, fangs bared. For a good while, there was nothing but the two of them. Redwood hadn't done any wild conjuring since 1903, when she and Aiden had gone off to the Chicago Fair. That trip seemed like a dream, a story she told on her young self. Who could say if it was true or not? She had known killing rage since then, and it had made her a stranger to herself. She remembered the wild young gal, beloved by the spirit and everything, not afraid of bears, gators, hurricanes, or crazy men wandering the night. She just couldn't find her. The lioness snarled. A tall figure in a black hat watched from the shadow of an old oak tree. If Redwood had lost her hoodoo power too, if this conjure trick called the Boneyard Baron to her and she died this day, at least Nikolai would get a record of her true spirit on film, and who would be able to deny that? The lioness circled Redwood, crouching till her belly brushed the ground. She drew her lips back over jagged fangs. The crowd roared and startled them both. Behind the lioness, a brave African savage dragged the blubbering handler toward a distant circle of folks who looked ready to run, but eager to see the show come to any gruesome end. The lioness's chest rumbled. "She's purring!" Nikolai reeled in the images, his eyes ablaze, his thin frame shaking. Saeed stood next to him, waving and speaking beautiful words, yet their meaning escaped Redwood. Perhaps Saeed was so desperate he spoke Farsi. Behind Saeed, one of the animal wranglers waved a rifle. Where'd he been all this time? "That's a growl, fool," the wrangler said. The Boneyard Baron tipped his hat. "She's all yours," Nikolai urged Redwood on. Saeed gaped at him. "Move out the way, gal," the wrangler gunman yelled. Redwood ignored him and tangoed with the snarling or purring lioness toward the cage. The sun dipped low, setting wisps of clouds on fire. Pain was out another day's wages. No more filming today. Redwood had danced the lioness almost back to the cage. Their emotions blurred into one another, and Redwood felt heartache for a time before this time. For sisters, babies lounging in the heat, and a great bearded fellow rolling in the grass. Redwood peered with lonely lion eyes through bars at a barren landscape of circus tents and train box cars. She turned her nose up at rotten meat covered in maggots and flies as each second stretched long and unbearable. Fire singed her whiskers, and she gulped a breath of smoke, coughed, and growled. The lioness batted a sore paw at Redwood, bringing her back to the smelly cage. "I can't, damn it! Sequoia's in the way!" someone shouted. Nobody dared get close enough for a clear shot. Redwood gently took hold of the swollen foot. The lioness laid her head against Redwood's hip. Redwood pressed her cheek against a furry ear, drawing the pus and pulling the pain from one paw, then another. With a rumbling chest, the lioness danced beyond reach to deep inside the cage, where bars kept the leering and snarling people out. She sat on her haunches and licked her paws, eyes never leaving Redwood. A shot rang out. Stunned by the force of an impact, by skin and bone exploding, Redwood's arms flew open. She stumbled and closed her eyes on a punctured lung and fatal heartache. A second shot whined by in the darkness and slammed through downy fur into soft flesh. And then Redwood could hear no more. Time was undone, bleeding away. Redwood opened her eyes. The lioness was twisting in the air. The second bullet had hit her belly and ripped her open. Guts poured out with blood. The white hunter and African savages stood behind a gunman, cheering and laughing. With fear standing in his eyes, Saeed ran into the cage. The dead weight of the big cat fell into Redwood. She hugged the animal to her. Claws dug at her ribs as they tumbled to the ground. Blood spurted onto Redwood, sticky, hot, smelling of copper and bile. The lioness's tongue flapped against Redwood's shoulder. Coarse as sandpaper, it scraped away skin. Puffs of bloody, fetid breath fogged the air. Golden eyes turned glassy and gray. Grimacing, Saeed rolled the lioness off of Redwood's heaving chest and talked at her, but she couldn't hear him or anything else. He looked concerned at her injured shoulder and the blood dripping down her side. As he checked her wounds, she pushed him aside with such force he tumbled several feet into the ground hard. The wind was knocked from his chest. Saeed scrambled in the dust to regain his senses and came for her again. Redwood jumped over the lioness and charged at the gunman, running faster than Saeed, running with gale force rage. As she bounded toward them, the white hunter and African savages grew silent, motionless, and then backed away. The gunman lost his grin as he noted their retreat. Panicked, he aimed his weapon at Redwood and shouted something, but she charged on. He fumbled and stumbled and then pulled the trigger at point-blank range. His rifle misfired, burning his fingers and dislocating his shoulder. Redwood smacked the gun from his hands and slammed into him. Terror and pain disfigured his face. She balled her storm hand into a fist. It took great effort not to punch him again. He fell down at her feet and clutched his chest like an actor miming a broken heart. She turned away from him, walked past a frightened white hunter and stunned African savages, past Saeed even, and back into the cage. Redwood sat with the lioness's head in her lap, staring through the bars. Saeed shrugged at everyone and sat next to her. Demon Nikolai cranked the last of his film. He nodded at Redwood, pleased, it would seem, with her bravura performance. Redwood took a choked breath. Sound returned, but she didn't want to listen to the voices babbling at her and wished for the silence again. It did not come.
Thank you.
people who always have self-service everywhere. You know, when you see them, they have self-service no matter where they are. And then when they're playing their instruments, they stay in tune no matter what the weather's doing.
Who are those people?
I see them on screens.
Yeah, they have like five people backstage tuning up all their stuff for them.
Yeah. This is a later chapter. It's 1913, and Aidan and Redwood have been having hard times in Chicago. So Redwood sets out a crossroads spell and asks Aidan to read from his journal. And when he was young, Garnet, Redwood's mother, told him to write yourself down, Aidan. Keep good counsel with your own self. That's a powerful spell, a hoodoo trick for whatever ails you. Well, Aidan is feeling too low to read from his journal, so Redwood reads to him. Walk in the stars. Stories and songs are medicine too. Aidan's father, Big Thunder, was of the Wind Clan, one of the first clans to come out the mountains when the Master of Breath called the Indians from the navel of the earth into life. Wind Clan was whirlwind friend to Panther Clan, clearing away giant roots so that his big-headed brother could make it into sunlight. The other clans tumbled in after that, deer, bear, corn, bird, potato, and all the rest. Big Thunder had to marry across the fire. His first wife was Snake Clan. His second wife, Ashlyn, was an O'Casey from County Cork. They married far across the fire. Your parents are dead, Aunt Caitlin said to Aidan Wildfire. You are Aidan Cooper now and nobody else. Those mountain people you live with got taken by fevers and coughing sickness. You are strong stock, lucky. You take after Ashlyn, and I love you as my own. Don't go running off, hiding in the swamp, acting like a wild savage. Aidan was young, and sadness was sharp nettles clinging to him, digging deep, drawing lifeblood. He missed his parents and the clan of mountain folk who had made the world home. Aidan cried in the night. He grew sick and pale, not from coughing or fever, but grief. Finally, When Aunt Caitlin couldn't get any food to stay in his belly, she took Aiden to Miss Garnet Phipps and pleaded with this colored conjure woman to hold her adopted son to life. Miss Garnet sent George and Redwood to help their daddy in the fields. She had Aiden gather hairy roots for a healing brew. They watched it boil in a black iron pot. A dead smell filled the house. When darkness fell, Miss Garnet stood by Aiden on the porch. The moon didn't even bother to come out. The air was a heavy blanket of heat. Aiden felt a chill in his heart all the same. Shooting stars! Miss Garnet pointed at streaks of light. That's a sign for sure. What the stars got to say to us? Aiden asked. Miss Garnet sang a star song in Gullah Creole, and Aiden could only feel the meaning. A traveling song, a song for loved ones far away. I knew your daddy since I was younger than you. She put a warm cup of the nasty brew in Aiden's hands. His people and my people been around these parts for a long time. I got family over to the Sea Islands still. My daddy knew folks from everywhere, Aiden said, proud of who he came from for a moment. Aunt Caitlin said I shouldn't talk about him. I'm a hoodoo. Here and underneath things, you can't hide the truth from me. We can talk about your daddy and your mama too, if you like. Just us. I won't tell nobody. Aiden put the cup to his lips and drank the medicine down quick. It was sweet and frothy and felt good going down. His tongue tingled and his belly didn't feel so tight. Miss Garnet sat down in the rocking chair and opened her arms. Aiden crawled in her lap like he was a little child and they rocked together slowly. He liked her hickory smoke, sweet magnolia scent. She wore an orchid in her hair. Seemed like it was growing there and not fixing ever to die. Your daddy told me a story once about the Milky Way. She pointed to the stars. The master of breath blew into the sky and made the white pathway, Aiden said. He told you too. Well, ain't that something? Yes, the white starway leads to a city of light where good people go when they're dead. Gullah song tell a similar story. Your mama and daddy are there smiling on you, hoping you have a long life, a good life, before you walk the stars to them. Well, Aunt Caitlin don't believe in the Milky Way. Uncle Charlie neither. It's up there in the sky for us all to see a prayer every night. A good story fill you up when you're hungry, when you're lonely. A good song take the hurting out your spirit. No harm believing in that. She gave him a wind-up music box. Play this and think of the stars smiling on you.
So high. Blue is the color of my heart. shrinks to fit a 15-inch screen against which crows and angels anxiously beat their wings, seeking escape from this bright and flattened world. Nothing left to touch, too much to feel, too much to feel.
Andrew's book, Redwood and Wildfire, right back there on the table. My record's there too, but you know.
And then anyway. Do Aiden's last song.
Yeah, oh, good idea. I'm going to do Aiden's last song. Hopefully not his last song. What about the sequel?
Okay, that's in the sequel, right? Because it's in the next book.
Holding in your holding in your holding in your
Pan Morgan, Andrea Hairston performing live at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings last March 6th. Whew. I mean, okay, you know, come on. What you know, yeah, it wasn't your normal science fiction reading, but how do you define normal science fiction reading? If you can, then that wasn't it. Okay, the Pan's new CD is called Wild Blue and is available at music sellers everywhere, but you can visit her website at PanMorigan.com. AndreaHairston.com, H-A-I-R-S-T-O-N, will tell you about her new novel that you are hearing readings from, Redwood and Wildfire, in print from Aqueduct Press. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Lister, for use of some of your airtime that I, you know, ill-timed out. Let me tell people, if you enjoyed that, well, we've got another reading coming up this coming Tuesday, 7 p.m., 138 Sullivan Street. Barbara Krasnoff and Lev Grossman will be doing Materials of a Different Kind of Culture, but it will challenge your concepts of science fiction and fantasy again in many ways. I hope that you will be there. For more information, visit my website, ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. We have exciting stuff for you coming up through the entire month of April. So in the meantime, thank you for listening. Happy April Fool's Eve, and stay tuned for Burn Baby, Burn Clappers.
They made in a garden, walking alone. TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Calling all filmmakers. Metropolitan College of New York is hosting its second annual Media Management Short Film Festival on April 7th and April 8th from 6 to 9 p.m. Telling Stories, Shaping Dreams is the theme of this two-day film festival. Thursday, April 7th will feature a moderated industry insiders panel discussion and filmmakers roundtable. Friday, April 8th will feature screenings of 12 amazing short films from around the world. Both events are free and open to the public. For more information or to RSVP, visit Metropolitan College of New York's Facebook page at Metropolitan College of New York Second Annual Short Film Festival or visit mcny.edu.
Yep, this is Brother Cornell West, and I hope you understand it, that in Harlem, on April the 11th, this is the occasion of Basics, which is a celebration of revolution and a vision of a new world, that you should be there because you're going to see a love for poor people and working people. You're going to see an alternative to the world in which we live. You're going to see a critique of the capitalist system that you need to check out. You're going to see courage, vision, and folk who love the people enough that they're willing to bear witness against this oligarchic mess in which we find ourselves.
Basics is a new book from Bob Avakian. That's Monday, April 11th, 7 p.m., Harlem stage at Aaron Davis Hall, on the campus of City College of New York, a celebration of revolution and the vision of a new world. Buy tickets at Revolution Books or call 212-691-3345.
Be there.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Inferno,
burn, baby, burn.
Turn that mother light. refrigerator fashion. Station WBAI.